Well, thank you very much for the invitation. It's always very nice to be in Newcastle and Gateshead. I'm not going to talk about my own work because I'm not an architect, I'm not an artist. I work currently in an architecture school, but my work is really in writing. My first degree was in fine art. I was a painting student at Chelsea from 1968 to 71. There was no course, you just had a letter that said when it started and that you should make work on your own initiative. Probably it would be quite hard to validate that today, but actually it's a much better model than anything that runs now, I think. Because what it gave me, apart from an amazing horizon in terms of, gosh, this extraordinary art world and world beyond the art world out there, being in the late 60s was an optimism. The world was going to change for the better. It didn't. It got worse. But I've never quite let go of that optimism, and I suppose that really is the only thing that gives me the energy to go on talking about any of these things now, because if you read the material on climate change, it's acutely depressing. It's probably too late. We will probably certainly have 2 degrees warming. That means quite a big rise in sea levels. The ice is melting at a runaway rate. If the methane comes out of the tundra in Siberia, then we're all completely finished. It'll be 4 to 6 degrees. The planet is not in trouble. It's not about saving the planet. The planet's a lump of rock spinning in space. It'll do that for millions of years, regardless of us. It's actually us that we need to save, because most of the things we're doing are making it really rather difficult. So there should be a health warning here, that the background is deep pessimism and a tension, creative tension, between that and my sort of long-term optimism, that I still feel, well, there is something else. Another world is possible. If I'd been giving this talk 20 years ago, I would probably have been relating to things like species extinction. That seemed to be the big issue. And I suppose, actually, even before that, from Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, which is now about 50 years old, profoundly important book in its time, that just wrote about the activities of the chemical industry reducing wildlife. So mass spraying of crops kills off all the bugs, which no longer eat the crop, but there's nothing for the birds to eat, etc., 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 and you get poison in the river, and so on. It's a book which I think is still worth reading, quite beautiful. Very heavily put down by scientists in Carson's own time, because she was a woman, because she didn't have a PhD, and she was pointing, I think, more to some rather dangerous connections between a major part of the military-industrial complex, which now we might call the military-security-industrial complex, it's still very much there, and the death of the environment. Artists responded to that in all sorts of ways, and they still go on doing so. Now, I'm not giving any kind of prescription. It's not for me to say what you should do. It's not for me to say what artists should do. That's up to them to decide. So I have a dozen examples of work I personally find interesting because it has some aesthetic quality as well as a content that is perhaps appropriate to what we're discussing today. Under this umbrella term of sustainability, which I find actually a really problematic word, most of what's talked about is sustainable economic development, which is complete bollocks. There isn't any such thing. If we really want to be sustainable, we have to have a radical change to the economic system, and it has to shrink hugely. That's very, very difficult, and it may not happen, but we'll see. However, way back in the mid-1980s, sculptor Peter Randall Page made this series of stone carvings in Purbeck limestone for a bridle way along the Purbeck coast in Dorset, in the south of England. They're still there. I went to see these last year because I was writing a book and I wanted to put pictures in. And two of the three, which you see, have survived remarkably well. And partly I think I like them because there was nothing that said they were art. They're just there. They're like little wayside things. Sometimes I've noticed people put little wildflowers in front. People sometimes touch them. Sheep rub up against them. They're very much part of the landscape. They're made of what part of the landscape is made of, and that rock is itself made of shells. So there's a quite nice series of connections there. But there were some difficulties with this species stuff, because it was mainly, if you look back to the sort of the 80s and 90s, it was all about nice species. Save the whale. Because whales, they made records in the days of those black, shiny things you put on gramophones. of whale songs, whale music, which is some kind of communication that whales obviously do use between each other. They may not call it music, because that's a sort of modern European word. But it was all about nice species. It wasn't about wasps or bed bugs or cockroaches. And I think there's a tendency that creeps into some of these debates, first of all, to anthropomorphize the whole problem. Secondly, a kind of white middle-class Western sentimentalism that looks for, oh, wouldn't it be nice if we could save this and screw the rest of it? That's never going to work. There's nothing against saving them. I'm all for saving the whales. I'm also, by the way, not against art, although I'm sometimes very critical of it. Far better to give all the money to the Arts Council than to renew Trident. There's no doubt about that. But there are some issues within what happens to it. And, of course, there were people like Andy Goldsworthy and many others, the sort of, you know, the Twig Brigade, making nice sculptures out of things in the landscape. And, you know, it was great that sometimes they're really beautiful. These are both by Goldsworthy. I do wonder what was the eco-footprint of his trip to the North Pole, because as far as I can see, ScotRail doesn't go that far, and you probably need a helicopter and a support team. I just wonder how much embodied energy came to make this one-day ice sculpture, which makes beautiful photographs in glossy coffee table books and is excellent art and so on. And there are, you know, there are real qualities in his work. He's a major artist. I'm not denying that in any way. I'm just trying to make the point that some of the ways in which culture has been used for ecological or environmental purposes, just as in urban regeneration, so-called, which usually, by the way, doesn't regenerate very much other than the property prices, leaves certain gaps. And it seems now to be rather urgent to get very realistic about this and say, well, can we actually do anything? What would that involve? But then there's another difficulty, because it all becomes apocalyptic. This is called the Wee Man, W-E-E-E, Waste Electronic and Electric Equipment, which is at the Eden Centre in Cornwall in a disused china clay quarry. And it's this great skeletal figure, much bigger than the human spectator, made out of junk. And it sort of, yes, it brings home to you how much junk we produce and get rid of, and it goes usually to landfill. But it's a kind of frightening statement. And if there's a problem with nice, sort of save nice species with nice images of nice landscapes and whatever, there's also equally a problem with the nasty side of it, frightening people or preaching to people. It just doesn't seem to work, or it hasn't done for the last 30 years anyway. So these sort of death images, I think, actually are quite addictive. The sense of crisis produces adrenaline. Adrenaline is a drug. Like other drugs, it is addictive. You get hooked on crisis. Or on the script of the disaster movie, which isn't just about Los Angeles, it's actually the whole of human habitation now. And I think the danger there is simply to be drawn into it. And there's a kind of helplessness and a kind of pessimism inherent in that situation that I find quite worrying. I find that more worrying than the Save the Whale stuff. And what do we find? Well, it is becoming urgent. I live in Devon. Our railway got washed away a few weeks ago by the storms. I've never known such a violent winter. Climate change is really happening. Again, you know, 10 years ago, I might have been talking about, or 20 years ago, climate change will be fields of sunflowers in the south of England, and egrets, which are now all over the estuaries, exotic birds flying here, and there was some project for growing tea and coffee in sheltered Cornish valleys. They're actually doing that now. It was on the radio that you can buy Cornish tea. Turns out it's mixed with Indian to make it taste of something, I suppose. But you know, there was a point where people said, oh, global warming, it'll be nicer. We'll have all those lovely flowers in the fields. No, it's actually devastating. 90 miles an hour winds about 5 miles from my house. Fortunately, it was in a sheltered position, but the railway just washed away and it won't be ready till the 4th of April. And the plight of all sorts of species, including polar bears, they're actually very aggressive animals, and they may well not be around for that much longer. So it was very interesting that a couple of years ago, both New Scientist, popular science magazine, weekly, and The Sun, probably not many of you know what The Sun is, it's a tabloid daily newspaper read in England, both of them had the same map showing what will happen to the world by 2099. And The Sun actually went further and said it could be earlier than that, it could be 2049. And the only habitable regions will be the green strip that goes Canada, Greenland, England, Scotland, Britain is in there, Scandinavia, Siberia, a little bit of Patagonia, bits of Australia and most of New Zealand, and the Western Antarctic. That's it. There's a certain poetic justice that the whole of the USA and the whole of China will be wiped out, given that they are two of the key polluting nations, and both frightening in slightly different ways. But again, there's this notion of crisis, which produces either addiction or defeatism, and save the world again. So what does art do? And I have to be very brief, this is really condensed here. Does it provoke? Does it imagine or reimagine another kind of world? Or does it intervene in practical, participatory ways? Probably all of those. Different people do different ones, obviously. And I don't think it would be helpful to make a hierarchy, to say, no, this is the way, that's not quite as good. People do what they can, using the skills and the knowledge they have, and hoping for the best most of the time. So I've just got half a dozen examples of different things people have done. Cornford and Cross, David Cross and Matthew Cornford, two artists who work as a collective in London, producing their work here on the M2 motorway, just as it was about to be opened. I'm sort of assuming this is some kind of montage, but it might not be. I don't know. Photographs, it's quite hard these days to tell what's a fake photograph and what's a real one. But it's a very nice idea that the motorway should be blocked. Because if we are serious about sustainability, we have to get rid of cars, private cars. That really has to go. And it's easy for me to say that because I've never had a driving license. So it wouldn't be much use to me to have a car. I could sit in it in the car park and look at the view, I suppose, but it's more comfortable in my house, really. But you know, we have to deal with some quite sort of major realities of that kind. Cars are heavily polluting. They also sustain the oil industry, which is one of the most harmful global industries. And there is a very direct correlation, and a London-based group called Platform have produced huge amounts of stuff on this, which is all on the internet, correlation between environmental abuses and human rights abuses. And I'm inclined to say that these are actually all the same problem underneath. Another pair, that Heather and Ivan Morrison, produced this very interesting work here in its rural setting in Tatton Park in Shropshire, or Staffordshire, forget which, was also shown at the Barbican Gallery in their environmental art exhibition in 2009. And it says, "I'm so sorry, goodbye." It's a take on Buckminster Fuller's geodesic domes from the 1960s, which were meant to be environmentally friendly, picked up by the Whole Earth Catalogue and so on. But if you can see, there's a little sort of transparent thing on the top, which is like a little sort of spaceship viewing thing, as if this very, very craft made from pieces of wood, double geodesic dome, might somehow lift off and go to another world where life remains possible. I do sometimes wonder if the super rich have a fantasy that they're going to live in climate-controlled bunkers on Mars one day, serviced by robots. I suspect it may not happen, and that it could be very unhappy for them if it did. But anyway, there's a nice kind of lyrical dealing with that there, perhaps. Quite different for that in Helsinki. The French-German group Hehe, Helen and Heike, H-E-H-E, again, lots of stuff on the internet, worked with the combined heat and power station in a district of Helsinki, and this work called Nuagevia, Green Cloud, projecting a green laser outline of a cloud onto the real emissions cloud from the power station. For 1 hour on a specific day, after public talks, leaflets, meetings, all the usual ways of engaging publics, asking people to turn off appliances for that hour. And as they could, working with the power company, they could measure the exact output in real time. So as the amount of energy being used decreased, that changed the side of the green cloud projected onto the real cloud. So you could actually see, I switched my kettle off. Oh, look! It might be quite small if you just switch the kettle off, but you could get a sense of, I'm doing something. I wonder if that's actually quite important. You could, of course, argue that this is just an art project and it only lasted for a day and, you know, after that everyone's back to normal. I don't know. You'd have to go and ask everyone who was involved if that was the case or not, and it would be a major social research project. And I think you'd get very varied answers anyway. But the sense of being involved might be crucial. Somebody did do some social research on organic vegetable box schemes in the Southwest a few years ago. And they did, interviewed people who had the box and so on. And they found, yeah, obviously people like eating the vegetables, it tastes nice and so on. But what a majority of, more than half of the people said was, we also do it because we feel we're engaged in something. We feel we're part of something, and it's what we can do. We can join that. There are lots of other things we might not be able to do, but that's a possibility. So maybe there are these kind of small, very localized ways in which change really can happen. And maybe Henri Lefebvre was right. I can't go into the theory of this, but he has this thing called the theory of moments of liberation, which says basically it is available to anyone, anywhere in the world, at any time, to have a sudden moment of extraordinary clarity. In theological terms, it's called a moment of grace. He puts it obviously in atheistic terms. When the world suddenly seems clear, you say, oh, it's that! I see. And Lefebvre argues that these are completely ephemeral and inconsequential, often, but transformative. Reality is never quite the same afterwards. Something lingers. Maybe that's a source of hope in our present situation. Hey also did a work on Deep Horizon, the BP oil well in the Gulf of Mexico that had a big accident. Where they made a miniature version, a toy version of it, in a Lido in Cambridge, and staged explosions and sirens and pyrotechnics and so on. Yes, and he's waving his papers. What, 5 minutes or 2 minutes? 5 minutes. Oh, that's fine. We're well on here. I've only got a few left. More directly politicized are the group Liberate Tate, and again, lots of stuff on the internet, really interesting group, who work with Platform, who I haven't gone into today because they have such vast material I couldn't really quite cut it down enough. Liberate Tate have done free additions to Tate's public programs, if I could put it that way. But they haven't always told Tate first. But, for example, on one side you see one members of the group on the floor of the Central Hall in Tate Britain, covered in what looks like oil. It's actually a mixture of molasses and something that's not harmful. The figure lay down, two figures in black turned up and just ceremonially poured this over. And it looks kind of, I mean, you could walk in as a tourist and think it was an exhibit, because it looks vaguely Joseph Beuys-like or something like that. Truth to materials, and there's some stuff you could put in there to do with art, I'm sure. But it's actually a human figure covered in oil. Like the birds we see on the beach and so on. And the other side, which I think is really interesting, an attempt to donate one of the arms of a wind turbine, one of the blades, to Tate Modern's collection. Now, if you think, we heard about modernist architecture just now, form follows function. Well, the wind turbine is pure modernist, form follows function. It's aesthetically very simple and beautiful and white and pure. Wouldn't it be the ideal object for a modern art gallery? Obviously it would, if you looked at it in simple, straightforward terms. It's also quite big, so you can see that people are carrying. So they carried it over the Wobbly Bridge into Tate Modern to present to Tate for the collection, which made lots of people not quite sure what they were meant to do, because usually there's a negotiation process with an art dealer before you get the painting or whatever. They also organized with quite a large number, many hundreds of people who are members of Tate, to write letters asking them to accept it for the collection. So it actually created quite a big debate, and one which Tate had to take seriously because he gets a lot of money from membership. They can't just ignore all those people. And some of them were people of some status, no doubt. In the end, the trustees decided not to accept it. But both of these acts, of course, draw attention underneath to Tate's sponsorship relationship with BP, a global oil company responsible in part for the Deepwater Horizon, but for many, many other things. And if you look at what happens in places like Nigeria, you see that having oil is a curse on the country for the most part. And therefore using oil has major ethical implications, even before you get to its environmental impact, which is devastating. So I think one of the big difficulties we face is climate change just another disaster movie script? Is it something we're going to kind of have all the movies and work through and then get on to something else and business as usual? Because clearly the agenda is business as usual under the present unelected coalition regime, and in many other countries too. And if it is business as usual, that is hugely destructive of the environment and of all sorts of aspects of our lives and those of other creatures in our habitat. So I do worry a little bit about movies like The Day After Tomorrow that simply make it another story. And right at the end, the helicopters come in and rescue people off the rooftops. It's like the cavalry arriving at the end of a Western. And it's all right. And you can start again. It's almost as if nothing has actually changed. But it's got to change. And we have to live in very different ways. And I'm not sure how we do that, because one of the problems is campaign groups tend to be ephemeral, and yet there's quite a succession of them. If you think back to anti-roads protests, the dongas at Twyford Down in 1995 and so on, political protests, that the posters are from Lisbon, it's George Bush, the time of the Iraq War, it says terrorist, get him, very appropriate caption. Groups come and go, Occupy most recently. They don't last very long. And yet there's a kind of energy there, and there's a spontaneous temporary formation of a new society among those who are present. Again, I think that's a Lefebvrean moment. I think that's probably transformative for those who are there. I can't speak for them. I'm not there. I'm an academic. But looking from outside, it seems a great source of hope. So another world is possible, as the World Social Forum have told us, in German as well as English. But, what can we do as individuals? What can we do as groups? What can we do as members of society? I happen to, by temperament, live very simply. I don't have a car, I don't have a television, I don't have a freezer, I don't have a tumble dryer, a whole lot of things. I don't have a mobile phone. Things I really don't like very much and don't need and so on. So actually my footprint is relatively low. On the other hand, I live in a house all by myself, so it goes up for that reason. But I do also know that if I lived in the most frugal terms I could survive on, it might be worthy, but compared with what industry does in 10 seconds, it's tiny. So I might save half a fly somewhere around the world where industry is killing off 10 species a minute, or whatever. I've used that just metaphorically. And I did worry about that for a while, but I think you have to just cope with that and say, okay, that's kind of an occupational hazard. You can do what you can do. I don't take long-haul flights anymore. Actually, I didn't like them anyway, so I'm quite glad not to have to now. And I've been to lots. Why do I have to go to any more places? It's, you know, what for? I don't need to go to a conference in China or whatever. It's really tiring. Better stay and write. It'd be more fun for me, that. But it does have to become politicized. So I just want to end by emphasizing, I think there are things that art can do, or artists can do, and probably things that architects can do as well. There can be a sustainable architecture. There can be a provocative art. There can be a politicized art, an interventionist art, participatory art. All of that's very, very, very valuable. And it may raise awareness, and it may make people feel they belong to something and give them some sense of hope. And that would be terrific. But we do have to be careful. We have to be aware that this is very limited unless there is, at the same time, a major political initiative for a radical change of the economic system, known as capitalism, which, to my mind, is the underlying destructive principle that produces human rights abuses, environmental abuses, and if we leave it alone, we'll kill off our habitat. So on that optimistic note, thanks very much.